Now it's time to be educated and entertained by the country's most famous environmental scientist, Joey B. has researched grizzly bears, wolves, and birds of prey. He continues to travel all across America to bring you the very best that nature has to offer. Be ready to be amazed. Here's your host, Joey B.
Hello and welcome to Joey B. Outdoor Science and Nature. Man, do I have the coolest job. I get to travel all across America to bring you the very best that nature has to offer. Well, the sun rays are getting a little bit stronger. It's a little warmer outside and people are thinking about the spring. So here's the perfect topic for that: plants to attract pollinators. Well, I have the perfect guest on the show, David Alexander. He is a great naturalist, author, educator, an excellent outdoorsman, and I must say also a great friend. David, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Joey B. I appreciate being here. I'm a fan of the podcast, and I'm looking forward to talking to you all about plants.
Well, you know what, David? I know, obviously, that you just absolutely love to be in the outdoors. We were just chatting about your excursion on the ice up in the Adirondacks, but we're going to be talking about a little bit warmer times. So I'm going to pose a few questions to you. So my first one today, David, is what are your favorite pollinator type of plants?
Well, there's a variety of different pollinator plants that I enjoy. Sometimes, you know, it depends what kind of setup I've got. If it's dry, if it's medium, wet, dry, or if it's wet. So depending on where I'm at, I have different favorites. So one of the places I have a few pollinator gardens is in a wooded wetland habitat. So some of my absolute favorites include Joe Pye weed and ironweed and mountain mint and swamp milkweed. So a variety of pollinator plants that put out a lot of color and work to attract some beautiful insects.
That Joe Pye weed really is actually, when you look at some native species, that's just a beautiful, beautiful plant, really is.
The queen of the meadow is sometimes referred to as.
Never heard that. See, I always learn something from you. And something that came to my mind with pollinator plants, and something we sometimes forget, is vegetable gardens and the flowers that are there. And specifically with me doing chili pepper research and all, sometimes you're looking at these tiny little white flowers on chili peppers, and they have this iridescent purple stripe on it, and it attracts pollinators. So we sometimes forget, I guess, that there are, again, pollinator plants that are out there that we, you know, we're thinking about the Joe Pye weeds of life, but there's some other ones out there. Any other one come to your mind?
Oh, well, it's interesting. The insects have these compound eyes, so they capture that polarization of light, and they can see that iridescence, see colors that potentially, you know, we wouldn't be able to. So what they see is going to be different from what we see. You mentioned the garden. A lot of people are familiar with black swallowtails because you find them on your dill, fennel, and parsley in the garden. So you'll see the caterpillars munching on the plants. And your first reaction, you might be upset that you've got bugs in your plants, but then you realize, well, you know, you've got a wonderful plant for your kitchen, but also to attract pollinators like black swallowtail butterflies.
And as you mentioned that, my sister, the scenario that you just described was something that happened a year ago in her garden. She planted dill for the first time and she was sort of upset. And then she did some research and she goes, black swallowtails.
Yeah.
So my niece Gabby got to see them, you know, go through all the stages. Yeah. So it was pretty neat. Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah, again, they're pretty. Yeah. And if you poke them, they put out these funny looking osmeterium, these little orange nodes that come out of their head that also have an interesting smell to keep predators away.
Yeah, no. Insects have, and so some reptiles have some great defense mechanisms, and that happens to be one of them. So when we're talking about pollinators, and you're mentioning a few of the plants, what pollinators do you see visiting?
Definitely monarch butterflies, since I go out of my way to put in quite a bit of milkweed to provide for them. And then I have that available for raising them and sharing with the kids that I educate. But also we've got I see quite a bit of painted ladies and swallowtails, morning cloaks, silver spotted skippers, Definitely quite a bit of honeybee, many honeybees, because, well, we have honeybee hives nearby. So the honeybees will take advantage a lot of those same pollinator plants. There's also a lot of small bees, like sweat bees and carpenter bees and mason bees that, they're not as large and charismatic as like a bright orange monarch, but they are out and about taking advantage of that nectar that's in the garden.
We will talk about bees a little bit later on, absolutely. But again, if you can create some type of garden, and we'll just talk about butterflies because you just mentioned a few. And you know what? If you can create a garden and it has all these butterflies, you're getting to enjoy the beauty of the flower, and then you're getting to enjoy the beauty of the butterflies as well. And that just adds so much to it.
Right. Now, yeah, you win praise from both people and pollinators.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's funny, me moving on to a farm in the Sourlands, it's funny that and last year was sort of a blur in the first year out in the Sourlands here, but there's many new insects that I have not seen before. And because it was a blur of buying tractors and moving this and that, I really didn't get the opportunity to spend the time to learn about these insects. And that is part of my goal going into this year, is so I can learn more too. And so to speak, see my new neighbors, all these insects that are there. Now, one of the things that I noticed here, there are many hummingbirds. Tell me about hummingbirds and plants to attract them.
Sure. Well, where I live in New Jersey, we have the ruby-throated hummingbird. And I tend to see them once the cardinal flower is in bloom. That's one of their favorites, as well as jewelweed. Jewelweed often grows wild in wetland edges or wherever there's a little bit of sunlight. But I let it go within my gardens as well, because it is so beneficial for the hummingbirds, and well, also for us, because the jewelweed provides itch relief from sunburn or mosquito bites or poison ivy, which you may have potentially in a garden. So it's the ruby-throated hummingbird and cardinal flower and jewelweed are two of my favorites for that.
And it's funny that you mentioned the jewelweed. I happen to be highly allergic to poison ivy, and the jewelweed has that fleshy stem that you can break and just rub it on as soon as you need to know that you've touched the poison ivy, but it's there. And you mentioned the cardinal flower, and it is a beautiful, beautiful flower. Now, one of the things, and you know my good friend Inspector Dave in the organic garden, and he grows Mexican sunflowers, and it attracts so many butterflies, but it also attracts hummingbirds. And one of my, every year in my gardens, I always do what I call is an experimental plant. Most times it's a vegetable, but this year it's going to be the Mexican sunflower to see if I can attract many hummingbirds with it. Now, question I have for you, Dave, is if you wanted to, you know, create a new garden, add to your garden, where do you buy pollinator plants?
So fortunately, there's more and more nurseries that are selling native plants, which tend to provide quite a bit for the pollinators since they've evolved alongside those pollinators. In New Jersey, we have a New Jersey Native Plant Society, and I made a map for them that it's a Google interactive map that shows all the native plant nurseries within the state. So you can zoom in on where you live and see where the nearest native plant nursery is to you. So it's very likely that you might have a native plant nursery within your state or where you live. Very likely that you might have a native plant society near where you live. And if you get in contact with them, they may be able to provide a list of where those best pollinator plant nurseries are in proximity to you. So you can also check in with your local nurseries. A lot of them would be glad to source plants for you. If they don't have them already in stock, you can always provide a list of what you'd like, and they can find ways to source them. And hopefully they can find them locally, because if you get those local ecotype plants, you're going to have a plant that's better adapted to survive within your yard.
And you just mentioned something that's really key, is you don't want to purchase a plant here on the East Coast and put it out somewhere in Arizona where it's not adapted to that dry, arid condition. and probably not going to do well, and vice versa. So finding local plant, local native plants would be really important.
Yeah, and the tags will share information about the zone that the plant can grow in and what kind of sunlight it requires or what kind of soil or what moisture level. So there's quite a bit to pay attention to, but I recommend just start small, pick a few. You could pick a few plants like milkweed, maybe a swamp milkweed, maybe a Eleatris, a blazing star, maybe some giant hyssop, agastacea, maybe some mountain mint. So you might just pick a few favorites and start there. And then part of the fun of the gardening is over time you collect new plants of interest and you add to your garden.
Well, I think that's also important. What you just mentioned is starting small, because too many times, like you think about vegetable gardeners for the first year they plant them, their gardens, they just make them too large and it's hard to manage. And when you start small, it's easier to manage that. And even with your native plants too, start with a small garden. You know, it's peaceful. It's all the things we love doing, because when you're out there, you're out in nature. And even if it's a small little backyard garden, you might be a city dweller and have to do it in containers, which is still fine. And it's funny how many people can attract, you know, different pollinators to a container grown plant in the inner city. So, I mean, they're everywhere.
Yeah. Yeah. Containers are terrific. They're a great way to also make sure you know what you have. So if you plant one plant per container, you'll be sure to know what it is. It won't get confusing and you won't forget what you've got. So I use quite a few containers, especially when I work with volunteers and interns when we need to do weeding. So it makes it very easy to know what should stay and what should go. There's a lot of plants that do tremendously well in a container. I just worked with a Girl Scout on her gold award. I called it barrels for butterflies. So the idea was to put some butterfly pollinator plants within a few barrels around her community to help attract pollinators, but also to just share an enthusiasm and some education on pollinators around town.
Hey, and anytime we could help our youth out and expand their knowledge, again, they're the next generation of people to attract pollinators. That in itself is just a great thing. Now, so we talked about, you know, buying these pollinator plants. Are there places we should avoid purchasing some of these plants?
So some of the big box stores have used neonicotinoid pesticides, which helps maybe protect the plant from pests, so it comes to the store in good shape. But then you put that in your garden and it can be quite harmful to the insects that might then visit that plant. So you want to make sure that what you're purchasing is healthy and hasn't been applied with any chemical pesticides.
That is key, because you and I are organic guys. So all that really, that's a great point there. And this show is brought to you by Ramsey Outdoor Stores. Whether you shop online or one of their stores, your experience will successfully gear you up for your next adventure. Go to RamseyOutdoor.com. So if I'm talking about my garden, how do I know what to plant in the space that I have?
So one thing you can do is you can sketch out a plan. So you might have some plants that are short or medium height or tall. So you want them layered. So your shorter plants aren't going to get hidden in the back from your view, but also from sunlight. So you want to plan for some depth in your garden in terms of height. But also there's other things to consider, like bloom time. You might select a garden that specifically all blooms together at a certain time of the year. Like I have one garden that's full of ironweed and goldenrod, and it blooms incredibly well August to September, a little bit possibly into October. So you might consider the bloom time. You might consider color. You might want a certain color to pop in your garden. So you might choose plants based on color. But there's also plants that appreciate different amounts of light, certain kinds of soil, or maybe you're trying to attract a very specific pollinator with a host plant. So you might have specific plants in your garden to try to attract specific pollinators or wildlife.
No, that's what you just said. Great comments about it. And I know that the world wants to just somehow search on your phone for something or search on the computer, but going to those stores, you know, the stores, I guess you might say that have lots of books inside of it, you know, one of the bookstores, I'm joking. And there are great books on companion plants, butterfly gardens, and it may just be for somebody who's a novice, might just be a great place to start as well. Now, I have a question is, so someone, because again, we have an international audience that is listening here. So someone in wherever, Belgium might be listening to us today. How do I know if the plant I want to use is native to my bioregion?
So, at least here in the United States, our forestry service, there are some websites that'll help to map out the location of these plants. There's apps as well now. There's like iNaturalist would be a good choice if you were to go on iNaturalist. As people take photographs of plants, it'll help to show within the landscape where they live geographically. And then when you properly identify the plants as well, it'll give you information about their range, their distribution, their origin. So some of these new plant identification apps will also have information built in to let you know if they are native and what range they are native to. So I think the best bet is using those apps, but also spending a bit of time online and finding local conservation organizations that can help guide you in the right direction.
Yeah, by me, as you mentioned that, there is a Sourlands Conservancy. And anytime you have a question about a native plant, you can pose the question to them. And again, they will give you information and advice. And sort of, if you're off a little bit, they will try to steer you toward the native plants. And the neat thing about joining the Conservancy, of which I have, is every year they mail you some type of native plant seeds, encouraging you to plant those on your property. Because there are so many invasive species that we have here, and which many invasive species, the reason why they are is they outcompete. And to get a stronger foothold, they're mailing seeds. And again, it's once a year, but I think it's just a really neat thing about, you know, just adding something back to, you know, bottom line is where it really does belong.
That's neat. I collect native seeds in the autumn and then we'll use them for seed balls with kids. We'll mix sand, soil, and clay with the wildflowers, with the native seeds, and broadcast them onto the landscape where in an area that's not going to get mowed. But I also package all those seeds up into little baggies. But anybody who comes for the Butterfly Tent Safari program that I run, or the Buzz Fest, or a Buzz Into Action class, will get a little packet of seeds to take home, just to help spread those valuable pollinator plants all over.
Well, you mentioned the buzz. So why don't you talk about your books for a second? Just, you know, give the audience a couple ideas about, as an author, what you've done.
Sure. So the first book I wrote was Hop Into Action, the Amphibian Curriculum for Grades K-4. Then I followed that up with a book called Buzz Into Action, the Insect Curriculum for Grades K-4. You know, as a naturalist, when I started it, I would take kids around on seasonal discovery walks, and you know, they kind of thought it would be kind of like more like a zoo where you're going to see charismatic megafauna. But the realities are, what you're going to be able to make stops and share are the things that are more accessible. So things like amphibians, things like insects, things like plants. So a lot of my curriculum writing started to go in that direction, and so I developed these two curriculums to try to provide lessons for educators to better be able to educate about amphibians and insects, and do so in a way that's meaningful and engaging, and that shares an enthusiasm for them. So the Buzz Into Action books got some fun ideas, like I mentioned, the seed balls, but there's activities in there like build a bug with clay and pipe cleaners, and to learn the anatomy of an insect with head, thorax, abdomen, six legs, compound eyes. There's pollinator scavenger hunts. There's information about monarch migration, that monarch migration game where the kids can play out a migration as if they're a monarch migrating down to Mexico. So there's a variety of activities within the guide that help kids to learn about insects and appreciate them. And a part of what's also included in there is information about a bug club that I've run for many years, and also the Butterfly Tent Safari and Buzz Fest programs that I've shared with the public for many years. So it's something I was happy to be able to share and provide all that I've kind of worked towards into one document, accessible for other people to duplicate if they wish so.
Hey, and I know this, David, that you're very passionate about who you are and what you do, and being a great educator, and then being able, again, to share that with educators who want to take a piece of that curriculum or all of it and run with it too. That's how the word spreads out there, and that's a good thing. So going back to our topic, are there ways, because deer, again, white-tailed deer, and I'll just use in the Sourlands, there are 7 times more deer here that should be here. Right. So they're overpopulated. Are there ways to avoid deer browse?
So one of the things that I do is I'll plant in groupings of the same plant. So a deer, there's very little that's actually deer resistant completely. But if you put things in groups, they might nibble a little bit here and then move along. If you only have one plant of each, they might nibble the whole thing and it's gone. So by having a multiples of the same plant, you can help to let them just nibble a little bit from a few, but it's not going to necessarily kill the planting group. There are some plants where you live that might be, you'll just learn over time. A lot of this is a progression. You just have to learn a little bit over time what the deer are into. I've learned that the deer will nibble down the common milkweed, but they'll leave the swamp milkweed alone, or the butterfly milkweed alone. So over time you'll learn, or even the Joe Pye weed, they'll nip the top of it in the springtime, but then they'll let it go later in the season. So, I do like to use split rail fences with some wire, like chicken wire as well, to try to delineate pollinator gardens and keep the deer out. Cause yeah, they do eat over 7 pounds of plants a day. But I also will use spray. I do have some deer sprays that are made with natural ingredients that I will occasionally spray my plants with so that they have a chance to grow in when they have those tender tips coming out in the late springtime before the deer get a chance to munch them down, so they can reach a height and build up some plant defenses so that they become more distasteful to the deer.
And as you're mentioning that, I was driving down the road the other day, and out in the front of someone's home, they actually had almost like a teepee set up, but a long teepee, almost like a longhouse. And it was PVC pipe with bird netting over it. Yeah. And I just saw it through the snow. And I go, wow, it's great. And I realized that may be a way that I could create something as I plant, because here I will be planting new gardens this year. Your comment that you just made about planting more than one of that plant. So if you're going to plant purple coneflower, don't just plant one, plant a few of them. And then maybe, because early spring, the plants are just so tasty to the deer, the young shoots. So trying to keep them until they can, so to speak, we always use the word, until they get a foothold somewhere. And then maybe we can take that netting off. That might be something I may try. Now, I happen to be Joey B, who is allergic to bees. But I'm going to ask you the question. Do you worry about whether you're educating or you're teaching people about bees that they might sting young children?
No, I do not at all. And that's through years of experience working around honeybee hives, in close proximity to honeybee hives, with school groups, camps, scouts, close by. So once in 17 years approximately, an adult was stung by a bee on her cheek. She had some perfume or something on her face. But I generally think if you're clean, if you're not like just eating an ice cream and you have sticky juice all over your fingers that attracts the insects, then they want nothing to do with you as long as you leave them alone. But I also, when I show the kids the beehives, I do ask them to kindly keep a distance. We don't stand in front of the entrance because that would be like standing on the runway blocking an airplane. And that would make those bees upset. So we don't worry about the bees. We respect them.
And I like what you just said. In Inspector Dave's Organic Garden, he speaks about, because he has the beehives in the back of it, and it's called the Bee Highway. And there's one specific way where the bees take off and they go on that highway. And if you stay away from the highway, you're good. And I'm saying you could stand right next to the highway, yeah, and you could actually watch the bees exiting and entering the hive. And then he's got a little water feature because bees need water. And you could be right next to the water feature and actually watch the bees come there to get their water. So it's pretty neat. And honeybees in general are not aggressive bees. And if you're just near them, appreciating them, learning about them, you typically will have no problem with them. Right. Now, how do I get kids excited about pollinators?
I talked a little bit about the Buzz Into Action book, and a lot of my ideas are in there. So I mentioned things like making seed balls and building a bug, going on a pollinator scavenger hunt. But, you know, how about just planting with them? You know, do an authentic activity and actually purchase some plants together and plant them and then watch them grow and see what insects come and are attracted to them. You could raise monarchs that lay eggs on your milkweed plants. You could then tag the monarchs and follow their migration with the Monarch Watch organization. You could take a block of wood and drill holes to make a nester block for bees and put that in a garden. So there's lots of ideas and ways to engage with nature get kids outside and just appreciating the natural wonders that we have all around us.
Well, and you mentioned that because where I used to live, if I didn't have a lot of time and I wanted to get out and get some exercise, I would get on my bike, put my helmet on, and pedal through my town and the town next to me. And sometimes on a beautiful May day, I would not see one child outside at all.
Yeah.
And I'm going, and I know where they're at, but in my mind, I'm going, where are they? And they're inside playing video games.
Yeah, near the outlets.
Yeah. And if we can do exactly what you said, is make them part of the process. Let them do some of the planting. Let them go out there and say, can you find me any caterpillars? So, you know, they're looking for the larval stages. And if make them part of the process, because then it's fun. And you hope that they're going to want to be outside versus inside. So here's my last question for you. In regard to plants and insects, what got you excited growing up about them?
More when I started working as a naturalist and started taking kids on the tours and recognizing the accessibility of plants and insects and amphibians. So I didn't quite recognize my appreciation for them until I became an adult and started to learn more. But also I was able to then get my hands on more of the resources, whether it was identification books and information or going on the internet and being able to learn more as part of a community. So to be able to connect with other people with similar interests in nature definitely helped my progression in terms of knowledge and enthusiasm for these things.
But I guess my question is sort of a little different is, what were you doing as a child in the outdoors? Were you into the outdoors?
Yeah, certainly. But I think it was somewhat just intrinsically what I was into. I remember sitting on a bus as a kid and just being more interested in looking out the window at the nature than having a conversation with my friends. Not that I didn't enjoy that social part of the ride as well, but I was always curious, just naturally curious about what was out there and And I think I appreciated the quiet and the peacefulness within nature. Whereas when you're a kid, you're just constantly in large, noisy groups. So I think I found some enjoyment just out of the quiet and peacefulness within nature.
Oh, it's funny that, and as you mentioned that, I love being with people, but when I can be in the outdoors and there is total serenity and peace, there's nothing greater than that moment in time. It really, really is.
Yeah.
So David, I just wanted to thank you for sharing your knowledge, because as usual, I always get to learn from you. So I appreciate you coming on the show today. I wanted to thank you very much for sharing your knowledge with us.
Absolutely. I appreciate being a guest and look forward to talking with you again.
Absolutely. And we need to get out into nature soon. So until next time, enjoy life's adventures.
You can follow all of my adventures online at joeybee.tv. That's joeybee.tv. And a very special thank you to the men and women of our armed forces for keeping us free, and for our police and firefighters for keeping us safe. May God bless America. Until next time, this is Joey B. Enjoy life's adventures.